Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain, while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions. As I'm sure many of you expected to hear Alan's voice this morning, we're reminded of the reality of what he does when he's not on the air. As a licensed private investigator and crisis interventionist, he gets calls and has to respond quickly, be it a locating a runaway, escorting a teen to a specialized program, or retrieving an abductive child. I wanted to wish Alan out there best of luck, and I'm hoping to see you soon. A listener had written in and asked about how Alan and I actually got together on this show, and the truth is that our friendship spans many, many years. We started working together when I was a director of mental health for Center for Discovery, a wonderful program that works with adults, adolescents with eating disorders, addiction, and mental health issues. Anyways, when we were working with young adults and trying to get them to our program, we often needed specialists, and Alan ran West Shield Adolescent Services. Trust me, trying to get a 15-year-old in a car and take him to a treatment program is not the easiest thing to do on your own. So West Shield would step in, and they were great because they understood how to communicate with young adults and get them to us in the treatment program safely. So Alan and I began working together then, and our relationship has grown. On to today. The subject today is on emotional clutter, and we all can relate to that. We've got an amazing guest today who will educate us on emotional clutter, but before bringing him on, I'd love to take a few minutes to discuss the science behind it all. I want you to take a moment and think about everything that's happened to you in your life. We all have stimulus around us, whether it's answering the phone, having your boss walk into your office, or even getting that first cup of coffee. These stimulus in our lives get paired with responses. When your boss walks in, without saying anything, you might already feel dread. This is because the response has already become conditioned to you. Think about your child. When they come home from school, they get in the car, and you ask them how their day was. If their response is conditioned and they start getting frustrated, it's because these questions normally lead to a fight or an argument about homework or school-related stuff. Anyways, these pairings of stimulus and responses always activate our nervous system. And we've got two main responses in our nervous system. We've got the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. The sympathetic nervous system is the one that you feel when you walk into a dark alley. Your heartbeat goes up, you start to sweat, you get this fight or flight reaction. And what happens is your muscles tighten, your stress goes up. This might be what your child feels when you ask him about school, or it might happen when your boss walks into your office. Now, this becomes an autonomic response. It's been conditioned. The problem with the sympathetic nervous system is it's the old brain. It's primal. And so it's not great for critical thinking, communication, decision making, basically all the prefrontal cortex stuff. So if you're being chased or in danger, it's great. But once it's activated, there isn't going to be great conversations going on or decision making. Therefore, if you're calm and relaxed in what we call the parasympathetic state, and your husband comes home and he's upset and sympathetically activated, the conversation won't go well. You really want to both be in that parasympathetic state, child and adult, or parent and parent. We both basically want to be parasympathetic activated whenever we communicate. So we need to figure out how to achieve this state of parasympathetic dominance and eventually pair our stimuli to a parasympathetic conditioned response. Remember, parasympathetic is the relaxed state. You get that after yoga, after meditation, after deep breathing, sex, and other things. The key to achieving this parasympathetic state is why we're bringing in our guest today. And along with getting into the weeds of that, we're going to discuss his new book on emotional clutter. Many have pointed out that the psychological benefits of clearing out the clutter in our surroundings. But what do we do with our emotional clutter? The psychological versions of the jam-packed closet or impenetrable garage. To talk about this today is Donald Altman. Donald's the author of Clearing Emotional Clutter, 1 Minute Mindfulness, and several other books that delve into mindfulness. Donald's a practicing psychotherapist and former Buddhist monk, an award-winning writer, and an expert on mindful eating, and he teaches neurobiology at the program at Portland State University. So without further ado, Donald, welcome to Answers with the Family.
Well, hi, Matt. I really enjoyed listening to your presentation and talking about these two different nervous systems and how we need to really get into the parasympathetic system. But thank you for the nice introduction.
Yeah, and I mean, let's jump into it. Emotional clutter. What is emotional clutter, and why should we worry about it?
Well, I guess one thing is, I mean, you could define it even in terms of anything that brings us into that emotionally dysregulated state when our sympathetic system is being activated. But I think of emotional clutter as, first let's talk about physical clutter. You can see that. It's very obvious to us. But emotional clutter is invisible, and that's why it's even much more potentially harmful to us. It can come from our childhood. It can come from family emotional clutter that we get, childhood trauma. It can come from the daily being overwhelmed, the daily stresses, the wear and tear, the grind of the day. And it can come from worries about the future. It can come from worries about things yet undone, about, well, what's my retirement going to be like? Am I going to be able to do this or that in the future? Or even concerns about injuries or accidents happening. I've worked with a lot of clients who have had overwhelming, fearful thoughts about things that are going to happen with their children. I mean, they were bizarre thoughts even, and weren't grounded in reality, but for them they were very real in the sense that it activated their sympathetic system, and then their mind was filled up with these thoughts, and they were unable to really be effective in the moment. And so that's when we can clear out that clutter. It allows us to be effective. It allows us to act based on our strengths and on the things that we have that we're and help us fulfill our potential. So it's a huge benefit to clear out that clutter.
And it sounds to me like it's something that can start in childhood and go into adulthood. And you said it's like the physical, it's somewhat like a physical, like a hoarding, but you're doing it in your mind. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say that's a good way of saying it. You're really hoarding thoughts in your mind. You're hoarding old, maybe negative experiences in your mind. And an example of that is, I could just share a story of a woman I work with. And it was very interesting. She came to see me. She was in her 60s, and during the evening I had with her, she kept returning to one old story. She got its tires stuck in her rug and keeps. So what she said to me throughout the session, the initial intake was, you know, my mother, she abused me. She mistreated me. And I took that in. I said, you know, that sounds like something we want to explore further, and we'll get to that. And I know that sounds like a very important story. But she kept going back to it, even though I tried to redirect her and assure her that, you know, we would get to that story in more detail. And at one point, I finally asked her, I said, tell me, I'm curious. I've noticed that you've told the story about your mother a lot, even during our short time together. And I'm wondering, have you ever tried to count how many times you tell yourself that story in the course of a day? And she paused, and she leaned forward in her chair, rested her hand, her chin in her hand. It's almost like she'd come out of a trance for a moment.
Amazing.
And she said, yeah, she said, you know, it's funny you asked me that. She said, I have tried to count how many times I tell that story, but I always lose track.
Wow.
And then she said, but I noticed when I don't tell that story, I'm a lot happier. So here is a story that was just filling up her head, and it was blocking her ability to really see what was around her. I mean, she could have been walking out to a sand beach in Hawaii, but her head would have been filled with this story. And so that's how the negative effects of clutter can damage us. And, of course, it was activating her that sympathetic nervous system that you talked about.
I mean, the energy that she put into it, and, you know, there's all these really interesting studies on happiness now where people focus on, you know, each day doing five things they have gratitude towards, but we spend so much energy in the negative things. The argument, though, the other side of that coin I get when I'm, you know, working with a patient is they say, well, then, you know, you have to know the negative so you don't repeat the same mistake.
Mm-hmm. And you know, there's some truth in that, too, isn't there? I mean, you do want to not completely forget about something that happened that might harm you in the future. But I think what happens is if you end up dwelling on it and it becomes it takes over our lives and it becomes real as if it's still there, then you have a problem. So it's okay to say, hey, you know, we have that nervous system that remembers those things, and we have a part of the brain, I call it the smoke detector in the brain, that is always looking for something that might be going wrong. And if you have a negative memory of something that was very dangerous, you'll remember that a lifetime. And it might only take a couple of seconds, and that event will be remembered. But it doesn't mean we have to dwell on it or live it, relive it as if it's happening right now. So when that happens, we're on high alert all the time. Now, that has a whole effect on the body that actually your body's putting out, your chronic stress state, your body's putting out constantly adrenaline and cortisol and preparing you for that fight-flight response. And what happens is cortisol will depress your immune system. I don't know if you can talk about that with your audience, but...
No, please expand. It's brilliant.
Yeah, that will depress your T-cell count, your NK cell, which are natural killer cells. Cortisol stays in the body. It'll actually kill the NK cell, natural killer cells, which fight viruses, even sometimes tumors. So here you are become more vulnerable to illness. And there's been a lot of research in this, so this is not very evidence-based and shown to be true.
We've come a long way from them not realizing the mind and body are connected, huh?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The mind and body connection, also from the body up to the mind. There's been some wonderful research that shows that how you hold the body can affect how you think. There's a wonderful study I'd like to share with you and your audience, and this is an example of this. It's the idea that they found people that were very depressed, and they asked them if they would submit to having a Botox treatment. And that treatment was they actually freeze the corrugator muscles. Those are the muscles that are the frowning muscles in the face. And so once they froze the frowning muscle, people couldn't frown. Their depressive symptoms went away because they couldn't make the facial expression that went with the thought of sadness or the thought of ruminating or the thought of, you know, anger.
Amazing.
Isn't that amazing? And likewise, if you smile, you're turning on a whole host of positive biochemistry processes in the body. If you see another person smile, you release dopamine in anticipation, even in ourselves. If you see someone else smile, dopamine is released, and that's kind of a reward, positive feeling neurotransmitter in the brain. So it's amazing to think that if you're angry, how are you holding your body if you're frustrated or you're impatient? Or are you tight? And I have people be more aware of the body, drop into the body, and that's a big part of clearing emotional clutter too, is letting the body, recognizing as an early warning system when we're not in balance. And so checking in with the body and then allowing the body to change and be more relaxed, more fluid, more flexible, and that can make our thinking more fluid and flexible and clear out the clutter. So it's interesting to see how many different ways to work with this, but definitely the mind-body connection is very much a two-way street, so to speak.
So now I've got to ask the California board to let me use Botox in my individual therapy, I think.
Or just have your client smile, right?
Right, exactly. That's probably easier. Yeah. I got to work on my humor then. The book Clearing Emotional Clutter, I love, and I love the getting off the emotional elevator. Will you take a few minutes to kind of talk about what you meant by that?
And this is really key. I want everybody to think about how you go up and down, how your buttons get pushed throughout the day. So things go your way, you get that promotion, you get a new house, that thing you always wanted. Maybe you have a happy thought about yourself, or somebody compliments you, and what happens? The elevator goes up, you feel good. Or things don't go your way. Maybe you have a health problem, get the flu, your partner leaves you, you have a thought about how I don't compare well to others, you look on Facebook, well, they're taking a vacation and I'm not, right? Maybe a friend ignores your text, and what happens? The elevator can go down. So here we are, consciously or unconsciously, even just having our moods go up and down with what's happening, both externally and even internally in our thoughts. And you talked about conditioning earlier, and a lot of that is conditioned thinking as well. And it happens very quickly that we can be conditioned to have that elevator go up and down. And then what happens? We start chasing the up elevator or starting wanting to avoid the down elevator button. And there's a way to get, it can be exhausting and very tiring after a while, right? And then you start fearing the down elevator and you want to go up. And so the real trick here is to get off the elevator, is to stop letting all these things push your button in. Find a place of equanimity, a place, a sense of peace and calm where your buttons don't have to go up or down all the time. And events just happen. And you can appreciate them and notice that they're transitory, they're temporary, they're not permanent, right? And you can have a completely different attitude and appreciation of what's happening in your life without having to have your elevator go up or down all the time.
Yeah, it seems exhausting, actually, just even hearing you talk about it.
Yeah, and it is, actually, isn't it? And I think at a deeper level, it's a form of suffering.
Yeah.
It's our suffering because we end up, being unhappy if we don't get in, if we can't hang on to the up elevator. And eventually that's going to change. It's not always going to go up. We can't control that. We're not happy because the elevator, we're perceiving it as going down. And the truth is that change is the one thing we can always is the one constant, isn't it? It's there. Everything's impermanent, transitory in a sense. And so we can appreciate that. That can clear out a lot of clutter. And I like to use the example of, you get a new car and it's shiny and bright. And so the paint is just, really glitters in the sun, right? Then it goes through the Chicago winter. I'm from Chicago, so use that as an example. And after you go through a Chicago winter, that new car, the luster on that paint fades a little bit. If you drive the car long enough, the tires will eventually go bald, and sometimes it happens to the driver. And it's happened to me. So, I can fight against that. I can be angry. Why did this have to happen? But this is the nature of how we grow older and change. But we also get more mature. We get richer in our experiences. So you have to look at the whole picture of things, and you can appreciate all of it. And but it is important to kind of recognize that when we're that emotional elevator, that if we're trying to hold on to only the good things, we're really missing the full palette of all the colors of life, the full richness.
And I love the emphasis on, change and evolution. And I think, especially in our field, things are changing so rapidly that, almost expecting for things not to change, you're in a worse place versus kind of embracing it and evolving and growing with it.
Yeah, and I really do think of this as clear emotion clutter is a way of kind of evolving our awareness and evolving our consciousness. I really think this is a very clear emotion clutter is a very transformative book in the sense that it can let us start to see things in a completely new way and start to recognize that kind of tap into that spaciousness of awareness that we have and not to be so locked into old patterns or toxic ways of thinking. So it's evolutionary, maybe revolutionary.
Yeah, and I don't want to give all the secrets of the book because I want people listening to go out there and get it, but there's another really cool term that you used in the book, this inner Facebooking, I certainly can relate to it. Can you share with the listeners what you meant by that and how it helps?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have a chapter on inner Facebooking in here. And so think about Facebook for a moment. And you go onto Facebook, and you're looking, everybody's putting up posts of things that are happening in their lives, and they're commenting on different ideas they've had, and so forth. And, and those Facebook posts that you see on there can actually affect you. The average person now, new information came out from Facebook the other week, that the average Facebook user spends over 50 minutes a day on Facebook.
Wow.
That's about 1/16th of your daily time awake.
That's amazing.
It's a lot of time, isn't it?
That's amazing.
But even more incredible than that is the inner Facebook. And this is the second Facebook that I think is so incredible, is the inner Facebook. These are all the mental posts that we put up each day. And scientists have said we could put up between 25 to 125 thoughts per second. Think of those many Facebook posts coming up on your computer. You almost couldn't see it so fast, right? That's an average of about, if you take the 25 thoughts per second, that's about 75,000 Facebook posts a day in your mind.
Wow.
Mental Facebook posts. And how many of those Facebook posts are actually accurate? How many of those tell you something profound about yourself? Very, very few. And so here we have this whole mechanism of these inner Facebooks coming up in our mind, and often they're not really helping us. They're not supportive. They're not encouraging. They may be inaccurate. They may be conditioned old toxic thoughts or just old reactive thoughts. And so, and this has happened to me a lot, too. I mean, there isn't anybody who doesn't experience that. And even though I've been doing mindfulness work, it still happens. I might catch it a little quicker, but it's still coming up in my mind. And I can kind of catch it. An example that might be, one time I was walking, I'm doing a little mindful walk, and I was in a beautiful area by the river down here in Oregon where I live, and it was very cold that day. And I hadn't anticipated that, so I didn't bring a jacket. I noticed the cold air rushing against my face, and a quick reactive thought just jumped in and said, "Yeah, it's too cold. I don't like that. That's not pleasant." Some kids were playing. I continued to walk, but some kids were playing, and I heard their voices. But my reactive mind just jumped right in again and said, "Well, those kids are so loud and noisy. They're ruining my perfect walk and meditation." But my expectation of this should be so peaceful and quiet and calm. And right then, a very subtle inner Facebook post shot across my mind. And if you're not careful, a lot of times we don't even hear these. And that's why we need to start to understand, start to look at our own inner Facebook. And that thought said to me, "Well, go back to the office. It's warmer, quieter there. You'll have a better walking meditation." And like a robot, I started to turn. And sometimes these inner Facebook posts, we can react to those like robots. But I caught it. I heard it. And I started to laugh, Matt. And I was laughing in this big field where I was walking. I thought, "Oh, so this moment isn't good enough. I'm going to reject it for somewhere else, somewhere better." And how often do you reject what is in your life or reject where you're at, thinking it'll be better somewhere else, right? And the energy we put into resisting what is in our lives right here is, again, a lot of where our suffering occurs,
yeah.
Right? Instead of being present with it and confronting it directly. And actually, in that moment, I just decided I was going to continue to walk. I was going to let in the cold air, let in the sounds of the kids, not trying to resist or fight, and just had a wonderful moment of present awareness.
Obviously with your history of being a Buddhist monk, and now I finally know one, which is good for me, is being present and in the moment, is that a big portion of catching a lot of this inner Facebook, like, weakness or whatever we want to label it?
I think that when we can hear what our thoughts are and not necessarily react to them, also, but just watch them, there's a real freedom in that, because we're not grabbed by them. We're not ensnared by them, right? We're not necessarily buying into them as the truth.
And even if they're negative?
Reality. Yeah, even if they're negative. We can even just watch those. I had a client I worked with. He was having anxiety attacks every day. And I think about the clutter there in his mind that goes into these anxiety attacks. And this father had a heart attack at a young age, so, when he would have little sensations in the body, he would have these thoughts, these catastrophizing thoughts. "Oh, my God, maybe that's the beginning of this new heart attack I have." And, but as we worked together, he was able to start to learn to just watch that inner Facebook thing and notice that those thoughts really had nothing to do with what was happening in his body. And he would say, he learned to watch those thoughts, and he would just say, "Oh, hello again, old friend." And I thought that was brilliant. He's going to try to fight those thoughts and resist them, or say, "Oh, the bad thought," right? he just saw it as oh, there's this old, wiring in the brain, which is what it is, this old rock. Here it is coming up again. You know, so, oh, again, old friend. So he didn't give him any power, didn't give him any strength. And that liberated him from that cycle of anxiety attacks. And he was able to just notice that.
Amazing.
Negative thought.
Amazing. And the recognition was, it was recognizing it and then not giving it the power that it used to.
Yeah, so it's about changing your relationship to the clutter. It's not that you'll never have any emotional clutter and have these thoughts, but you change your relationship to it, and it fundamentally alters your experience in that moment. And that frees you, liberates you from that kind of suffering.
In the flip side, the book does tons of focusing on actually finding your strengths. And that's, there's that issue gets touched on throughout the book. Can you kind of expand a little on that and why the strengths are really so important to us?
Yeah, no, I'd love to. You know, I think we're a very critical culture, and we can get very critical with ourselves. And I like to say that sometimes we have a committee of critical voices within us telling us, how to live our lives better, what we're doing wrong, and what we need to do right, and so on. And the truth is that we actually do have a lot of strengths. And a lot of us can devalue our strengths or diminish them or not even recognize them. And just say, that's my routine. It's just what I do on a daily basis. So what I'm suggesting here is that we start to become more aware and not take for granted the things that we do, but to look at these as strengths. And this is not a phony way to boost your ego. And I talk about strengths in the Emotional Clutter book, and how really we're kind of just balancing out the ledger here. We're saying, hey, you know, I can focus on weaknesses, but what are my strengths? And so, for example, suppose that you get up in the morning and you get dressed, you tie your car and go to work. You might not think it's a strength, but actually the truth is it required a lot of skills. So let's say you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you take a shower. Those are the strengths of self-care, really taking care of yourself. Maybe you got some food to eat, right? Again, self-care. Maybe you take your dog for a walk. That's a strength of kindness, caring about the needs of another. Let's say you get to your workplace on time. That's a strength of discipline, the strength of timeliness and respect for others. So, you can just go on and on and start to think about, wow, I really did all these things throughout the day. And I actually like to have people take a strengths challenge, which means that throughout the day, start to really notice as many strengths as you can, even the little ones. Suppose you've gone to the mall and you leave the mall and you go out into that big ocean of cars in the parking lot there, and you can find your car. That's the strength of memory, which a lot of us just discount. Right?
Yeah, these are applicable.
What's that?
These are daily applicable strengths that people have that they don't even recognize.
That's absolutely correct. I like how you said that. Daily applicable strengths that people have that they don't even recognize. And so this is about to bring it into our awareness and appreciating that we have this strength. And even the little things that we do, how wonderful it is that we, you tie your shoelace, right? Strength of mobility, and also the strength of motor, your motor cortex working, right?
Yeah.
Allowing you to do that. I mean, sometimes, I have a friend who's had very severe chronic illness, and for a long time he could barely eat, and he always commented, if somebody complained about something trivial, he just kind of laughed at that and said, I'm just grateful for any little thing. I could just swallow and eat a little bit of food. So sometimes we forget how much we have.
Yeah.
And so to appreciate the little things, I think, is very important. But appreciating our strengths, there's even been research that has shown that, and I include research in the Clearing Emotional Clutter book. I think it's important for us to know that a lot of these ideas here are actually have been substantiated in research. But it showed that even if you find one of your strengths and for a week, and this was actually done with people that had depression, and but believe me, I think these are great skills even if you're not depressed. I use these skills. I think it's what can be preventative medicine, you know, to help us cope, and not just cope, go beyond coping to fulfillment.
Yeah.
But this idea of just using one of your skills a day and applying it one time a day for an entire week and writing down what that was, what did you do. So let's say you have the strength of hospitality. Let's you identify, oh, I like being hospitable, I can do that. So maybe one day you smile at somebody. Maybe the next day you notice that you, at work, you ask somebody if you could bring them a cup of coffee or some water or something like that. Maybe you held the door open for somebody on another day. So if you're all these little things now, you know, but these little things create ripples and they affect everybody. And so you could also write down, how did it make me feel? How did it make that other person feel? What was their reaction, their response to that? And you do this for a week. And then the next week, choose another one of your strengths and do the same thing just one time a day. So here we are, altering how you experience your life, clearing away the clutter, and maybe connecting with others at the same time in a positive way.
Amazing. We the phones are ringing off the hook, so we're going to take a quick break, and when we get back, we'll answer the calls, if that's okay with you. Again, we're with Donald Altman. The book is Clearing Emotional Clutter. We are going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
Welcome back to Answers for the Family. Our guest again is Donald Altman. And Donald, you're a popular guy. We've got emails coming in and calls. So if you don't mind, we're very thankful to all of our listeners. And so I want to get to some of their questions. So this one's coming in and it says, several of the first through third grade teachers in my daughter's elementary school are using mindfulness training with their students and having amazing results, especially with the ones who have been diagnosed with ADHD and similar conditions. Best of all, their behavior at home has improved so much so that it's causing parents to question the truth and how their kids have been labeled and put on drugs by the therapeutic community. Can you comment on this?
Well, I tend to agree with that analysis. That I think I've had clients who had been diagnosed with ADHD and put on different medications, but actually, in some cases, it was a matter of just not getting enough sleep or maybe an overuse of video games. And I think it's a complex question, but I think on the one hand, I think technology can be fracturing our attention. And there have been some incredible studies showing that with young people that I think it's important with a developing brain to limit. And I know it's very difficult for parents, and I definitely feel for the plight of parents, but to try to limit some of that computer screen time. The average 8 to 18-year-old, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation study, spends about 7.53 hours, I think it was over 7.5 hours a day on screens.
Wow.
And one of the other studies that I saw showed that actually in preteens that they had tested them for their ability to notice facial recognition and social cues and emotions and they were very blunted in their ability to do that. They took this group away to an outdoor camp. They took their screens away, their mobile device away, and they interacted face-to-face, peer-to-peer, for 5 days. And then at the end of that time, they were retested, and they found they were able to, their ability to recognize those facial cues and emotions and went up, and it was recovered. That's the good news. So we know that this is built into our wiring, and it's the face-to-face interaction that wires up that prefrontal cortex, which is really the social part of the brain, our ability to have empathy and tune with others. And it's not face to computer. That's interesting, and we might enjoy looking at that, right? But it's why we very much do need, and our kids need, to have that face to face interaction. So, so it doesn't surprise me that there's more of these maybe ADHD type symptoms, but I think it might be related to over technology use. I'm not saying that's exactly been shown to be the case, but just kind of my take on it all.
Yeah, and our culture's changed so much. I mean, I remember it was you played outside with your friends until it got dark, or the streetlights came on, and then you went in, and now there's just so much isolation in people sitting in a room with the screen.
Yeah, and I see the benefit in technology also. I'm not saying that it's not beneficial, but I've also seen how it's important to have healthy boundaries with it. I think maybe that's the key takeaway from my perspective. I worked in an eating disorder clinic. I heard that you've done that work yourself, Matt. And it was an intensive outpatient program that I worked in, and that was a younger population. And many of them sleep with their cell phones under their pillows, and if somebody texted them at 2 or 3 in the morning, they felt they had to text back immediately. But they were compromising their health in doing so.
And I feel that too. With my phone, if someone texts, you naturally feel like an anxiety that you have to respond, and you're always on call. It's just a different society, which has some implications.
Yeah, I think in the broad strokes, I think that we are becoming a little too mechanized. We're becoming and as good as technology is, it's making us a little more robotic-like. And we're responding to things almost, believing we have to respond instantly. And I think it's important for us to spend more time in nature and to connect with others interpersonally. And that is really how we grow the kind of brain that is nurtured, cultivated in a very rich way. And technology can add to that, but it's not the only way of nurturing the brain.
The another section of the book, which I really loved, was the sections on transitioning. And one thing I thought was interesting is people assume, nothing but positive when you move or you take on a new job. But in the book, you talk actually about how transitioning from a place to another can actually produce this emotional clutter.
Yeah, this is something that's not usually talked about, but I have a whole section on transitioning in the Clearing Emotional Clutter book. And what happens when we're transitioning, and this can be there are a lot of different kinds of transitions, but if you're physically transitioning from one place to another, there's a lot of uncertainty about what's going to happen next, getting in your car or you're driving somewhere. And because there's uncertainty, feelings of anxiety arise. And this, again, is that sympathetic nervous system preparing us. Is it safe where we're going to? What's it going to be like? And when we're in transition, we're not sure how safe it is. So as a normal response, but what we can do about it is we can try to limit the number of transitions we make in a day. We can try to be more aware of our transitioning. We can do some grounding-type practices that I recommend in the book. Or even just, let's say you had 5 different errands you had to run and you're feeling overwhelmed by that. So I suggest just cutting that down. Maybe do 2 of those errands that are in close proximity to one another on one day, and then the next day, do the other 3. So in other words, just trying to manage your transitions, trying to be more aware of transitioning and the effect it has on you.
And I love how the book actually gives the tips you're discussing and then many more. Another really positive, and I obviously I'm a fan of the book, another big positive I thought was the discussion on friendships and relationships in the book. And you mentioned the 3 seeds.
I think that... again, it just goes back to the idea of that face-to-face connection. But, you know, there have been some wonderful studies that show how, you know, if you don't have good social relationships in your life, a good network of friends, that's as bad for you as being a smoker. Smoking, I think it's smoking 15 cigarettes a day, being obese, or being an alcoholic. Wow. Just think about the consequences of not having a social friendship network. So I really talk about in the book about how to build that, and I talk about the three seeds of friendship, which are trust, acceptance, and empathy. So trust being that key part and that takes time to build, the key element of, getting to know somebody over time and getting to disclose a little bit more until you really have a sense of trust built up, a sense of safety around being with that person and feeling secure with that person. That's trust. You need to have that safety. Acceptance means maybe not being so demanding with our friends always, knowing that everybody has a blind spot. Everybody has, some kind of a weakness or a flaw, and that's okay. So it means we can accept that in ourselves and others. And the last thing is empathy, and empathy is what really lets us feel connected to a friend and start to understand, how they feel. And with mutuality, they can understand how we feel. And that's a wonderful experience to have somebody like that in your life who understands how you feel, and that you're not trying to change that person, but just trying to say, hey, I kind of know what it's like to be in your shoes. And so if you develop those, you'll develop stronger friendships. And I think that's one of the great benefits of that life can bring, especially as we grow older.
I love the three seeds of friendship. And also, you know, you touch on really just listening and being able to listen as a barrier and to remove clutter.
Yeah. You know, I think I like to point out that there are a lot of talk shows, but very few listen shows on the air, right? And it seems like more and more we think how wonderful it is. Oh, I have an opinion on this, I have an opinion on that. But you think about that for a moment. If all you are all these opinions and you're always spouting that, how do you have space to listen? It's like a cup that's filled up to the brim with all your ideas, right? But to listen, you have to empty that cup a little bit. And so I have an acronym called HEAR, which means hear, and how to hear better. And the first three of these are how to empty the cup, the H, the E, and the A. So let me just quickly tell you what these are. So the A, the H, and this is in the Clearing Emotional Clutter book. I have a lot of what I call lifestyle tools like this that you can apply immediately in any aspect of your life. So the H means hold your assumptions. That means empty that cup, empty your ego, get curious, okay? You can always go back to those old assumptions a little bit later. E is to use empathy to engage, not enrage. So again, just trying to understand that other person better, right? Just trying to see not trying to change them or their point of view, not having to be right, just having to see how I can understand where they're at. A means absorb and accept. So absorbing, just try to see if you can take in what you're hearing, right? And accept means accepting that this person is where they're at, right? They don't need to be fixed. You're not trying, it's not your job, but you can just listen and you can accept that this is where they are right now. And now the R in the HEAR is how you would respond. And that means, the R means reflect, then respect. So first we want to reflect. We want to go back and kind of look at all that you've heard and all that you've learned here and think about how, you know, what wisdom or insights you might have about that, what it would feel like to hear that from this other person. And then when you're ready to respond, do so respectfully. That's really important. If you're angry or you're upset, then you need to wait longer and you need to reflect longer. If you need to talk to a trusted friend, somebody who you could bring shed a little light on this for you. But again, respond in a respectful, kind way. And that can shift any interaction you're having, even a difficult one, even in the middle of an argument, you can shift over to the HEAR, and that can change how you will interact and change the outcome of that argument or that discussion.
This is such great stuff. We have a comment, actually, not a question, but I thought it would be nice to read this from Patty J, who just wrote in. She said, I've been a mediator for several years, not as a religious practice, but for distressing and emotional rebalancing. It's fantastic to see a new approach to a somewhat similar practice welcomed into mainstream and accepted by people regardless of their faith or philosophy. I read a couple of reviews and bought your book last weekend because I felt the title was catchy enough to capture the attention of my friends and family who complain nonstop that their lives are out of control. This looks like the piece I have been waiting for to gift and recommend to them. Thank you so much, Patty J.
Oh, well, thank you, Patty. It means a lot to me to hear that, and that it's reaching out to people who can really, and like someone like Patty J, who's, I think it was Patty C or J, but who was also involved in working to resolve difficult issues with people and find that this is an approach that might help a lot of people. That's great.
And obviously, you know, we're coming to a close, but I would love to ask one last question before you leave. If you did have one word for reducing clutter, what would it be?
That word would have to be, I think, breathe. Take a nice, slow, long breath. And do this several times throughout the day. I think that, you know, if we're just aware of just a handful of breaths every day, that can help us regulate ourselves, help us discharge some of that stress and negativity, and clear out some of that clutter.
Donald, I cannot thank you enough for coming on the show. Those of you who want to get the book, Clearing Emotional Clutter is the title. Also, 1 Minute Mindfulness is another book. You can go to the website, www.mindfulpractices, MindfulPractices.com. And Donald, how can people get the book?
Yeah, well, you know, you can go to Amazon.com, it's a good place to get it. Go to your Barnes & Noble bookstore. Go to my website, and I have a link there. And if you go to the mindfulpractices.com website, I have a newsletter, a Mindful Living newsletter, and I'd like to invite everybody to sign up for that newsletter. And I have new reflections and contemplations that come out once a month there. It's new information on new mindfulness research and new events that I'm doing. So I hope you join up on the Mindful Living newsletter.
Thank you so much for coming on. And for those listening, tune in next week when our guest will be Philip Zimbardo, author of Man Interrupted, Why Young Men Are Struggling and What We Can Do About It. And if you missed or you want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answerforthefamily.com or check us out and subscribe to the show on iTunes. And the next time you're on Facebook and Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check some of our latest posts. And if you like them, please like us and spread the word. Thanks everyone for listening and have a great day.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.